From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Hayes Valley.
Rockridge in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, we'll peel back the layers on a sensitive topic that affects us all, mental health.
Culture makes a difference in the effectiveness of therapy. Culture makes a difference in how mental health is experienced, how it should be treated.
And we'll explore what that means specifically for Asian Americans.
So when the family people sees this problem, usually they try to hide it, you know, close it.
We'll also see how our mental health care system is failing to reach those in need.
To leave marginalized populations marginalized and unassisted is unethical.
We're exploring mental health from Asian American perspectives in this special edition of Cross Currents. Stay tuned. Dealing with mental illness is inherently challenging. Unlike most other diseases, it's often impossible to even describe.
Yeah, I think if I were to describe it, just like being in a dream state and not feeling like anything's real. Whether I go through good things or bad things, the feelings of just like this darkness I still have. Yeah, I think that's how we would describe depression.
That's Denise Sugita. She's one of nearly 60 million Americans who suffer from mental illness every year. Even though we as a society have become more open to discussing this type of disease and there are more options for treatment, there's still an enormous amount of stigma associated with it, and often more for certain populations. Sugita is fourth generation Japanese American, and her experience is emblematic of the many issues Asian Americans face when it comes to mental health.
So I think with my family, so it's a lot of keeping things within the family. I think just reputation and not wanting to look bad to other people. So, but even when I was trying to get help with the psychologist and being on the antidepressants, I remember my mom in particular being really disappointed with that. And why can't we just try to fix it on our own? Why do we need to bring in, like, other people?
Denise Sugita spoke with KALW's Erica Mu, who was awarded a California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowship to take a closer look at mental health from an Asian American perspective. She spent 6 months reporting on this topic, producing three stories. First, she takes us to Union City to meet the Liu family, Albert, Anne, and their three kids.
That's my wife with three kids, two daughters and one son.
Albert Liu is flipping through photos of his children that he keeps in his wallet.
This is my elder daughter. She graduated from the college.
He pauses on a photo of his second daughter, who we'll call Jennifer.
This is my second daughter. She graduated from the high school.
Jennifer was born in Taiwan, and she seemed perfectly healthy.
We consider She is a very brilliant kid, you know, because my wife gave her the puzzle. She is a very concentrating, you know. She always can finish the puzzle, you know. She doesn't need any help from us, you know.
We saw that she's a happy girl.
But at around age 4, Albert and Anne noticed Jennifer would hit her baby brother for no reason and talk to herself. It didn't seem normal.
Probably later, maybe.
Later.
When she was 6.
Yeah, when she was 6 or 7, and finally we think that it's more serious, it's getting bad, so I took her to see the doctor.
The doctor thought it wasn't serious. Around the same time, Albert found an engineering job in the U.S., so the family packed up and headed overseas. None of the children knew English, and that, combined with her behavioral differences, made Jennifer a target for bullies at school, Anne says.
After that, she closed her world.
Jennifer's school psychologist contacted Albert and Anne and said Jennifer was suffering from emotional problems and delusions.
Hallucination.
One time, you know, she said, you know, she saw some people came out of the wall, and sometimes we can see she's talking to herself, like talking to somebody, you know.
Albert and Anne had no idea what was going on with their daughter, and they didn't know how to help her.
Many Asian Americans are not getting it or not coming in for treatment.
Nolan Zhang is the director of the Asian American Center on Disparities Research at UC Davis, the only national research center that focuses on the mental health issues of Asian Americans. Dr. Zhang says that stigma might be one reason why Asian American families tend to wait much longer to access the mental health care system.
It's not surprising that once the ones that eventually get in have more problems and are more have more severe problems.
And those who end up in treatment?
They don't stay as long, and therefore they don't get the level of care that they should given their mental health problems. So even when a person clearly needs mental health treatment, they're not getting it.
Yeah, usually I believe, you know, that's pretty much like a Chinese cultural background, you know. So when the family people sees this problem, usually they try to hide it, you know, close it. They don't want to share it with others.
But Albert Liu didn't want to cover up or hide his daughter's illness.
But I personally feel this is nobody's fault. Sure, this is a problem. We have to open up, look at the problem, see whether we have a better solution for it.
Eventually, the Liu's were referred to a bilingual psychiatrist who diagnosed Jennifer as having childhood schizophrenia. Childhood schizophrenia is thought to be much more severe than when it appears in adults, and it's much more rare, affecting about 1 in 30 to 50,000 children ages 13 and under. The Liu's tried to raise Jennifer like a normal child. She even took piano lessons along with her older sister. But all along, she dealt with very severe mental health problems. In this recording, Jennifer's playing piano in a recital. But just a year before, she was hospitalized at the age of 14. She'd be hospitalized two more times before age 21. Throughout her teenage years and into her 20s, Jennifer took several medications to manage her condition. And even though the family was on a good insurance plan, many of her psychiatric visits weren't covered.
Especially for immigrants or other Asian Americans who don't have the financial resources to have insurance or to pay out of pocket, that is a serious barrier to access to care.
Clinical psychologist Joyce Chu from Palo Alto University says the barrier is more than just financial. There are also too few bilingual providers.
And in addition, I would go as far to say that it's not they're not situated in a way that they meet the ways in which Asian American individuals prefer to seek help.
But the Liu stuck with it. When Jennifer's third psychiatrist quit, Anne began calling 1-800 numbers in the Yellow Pages to find a new one. It took 3 months before the Oakland-based clinic Asian Community Mental Health Services accepted Jennifer as a patient. During my interview with Albert and Anne Liu, they get a call from their daughter, Jennifer.
No.
That's my daughter.
Oh.
Well, we are in a meeting. Yeah, we are in a meeting. 那我也不知道,但他不对,那你就没有什么要紧,你就 ignore 他就算了,对不对?就 stay away from the trouble, 对不对? Just stay away from them, 对不对?
So I'll call her later.
啊,对呀,那。
Today, Jennifer is still very dependent on her parents for support. Only last year did the Liu's figure out how to get Jennifer disability benefits and Medi-Cal coverage. They've had so much trouble navigating the system here that they founded a support group for other families like their own. In their monthly meetings, they exchange information in Mandarin and Cantonese.
Other newcomers, quite a number of them, they don't even speak English at all. You know, still, it's sometimes I don't quite 100% catch everything. Still, even today, you know, after being here for more than 20 years, and also sometimes we're talking, you know, that's a big pressure relief.
So that's why we would like to share this information with other family.
We try to help others, you know, what I feel if we can do something to make the whole community better, we'll do it, you know.
These days, Albert and Anne don't hope for a cure. They just hope that they can make sure Jennifer's in a safe place when they pass on. Anne is teaching Jennifer how to make fish patties and chicken nuggets. Albert is campaigning to get paid work for Jennifer and others like her.
I hope one day she can live by herself and doing some things for her. Even it's not a really she can do a lot, but it still could make her happy. Yeah, I know it's hard to tell her, you know, how we love her, but we just do it. Just like I told her, I say, I do anything that's under the guard, God would see what I did for you. That's what I think.
That's the story of Albert and Anne Liu, as reported by KALW's Erica Moo. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents. Today, we're taking the time to explore a single topic, mental health in the Asian American communities. In the story you just heard, we introduced you to the Liu family. As immigrants, they faced serious challenges finding care for their schizophrenic daughter.
Still, sometimes I don't quite 100% catch everything. Still, even today, you know, after being here for more than 20 years.
So that's why we would like to share this information with other family.
Albert and Anne Liu run a support group in Oakland to help Chinese families navigate the complex American healthcare system. Their hope is to remove barriers to care, including stigma, and to get families to open up to treatment. Asian Americans tend to wait longer before seeking mental health care, and they often have more serious problems when they finally see a specialist. This plays into a surprising statistic among Asian American women. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Asian American women ages 15 to 24 have the highest rates of depressive symptoms of any ethnic or gender group. The CDC reports that young Asian American women have the second highest suicide rate among their age group. The same goes for Asian American women over 65. Reporter Erica Moo introduces us to two women who have stories that shed light on that statistic.
The two women you're about to meet, both are technically Asian American, but they couldn't have more different backgrounds. Isabelle Thuy Pilo is half Vietnamese, half French.
I was born in France and I grew up in France, but I came to the U.S. when I was 19.
Denise Sugita is fourth generation Japanese American.
And I'm from Southern California, a smaller area called Ontario.
But at the age of 19, Denise and Isabelle both ended up at the same crossroads. Each woman tried to kill herself. Now, what led Denise and Isabelle to that point is a combination of factors, including their life circumstances and their mental health. Let's start with Denise Sugita. When you meet Denise, you might think, she's nice, upbeat.
I'm really passionate about social justice and making changes in the communities.
Denise is 28 years old. She lives in Berkeley and works on a campaign for underserved youth. She's not an outspoken advocate type, though. She's quiet, has trouble making eye contact when she talks about herself and her family.
Like, since I was really, really little, just having the first memories of me hiding in my room, like, holding my dolls or just trying to comfort myself, just hearing my mother and father yelling at each other and my dad, like, me throwing dishes around.
As she says this, she pushes up her glasses with her thin hands and looks to the table.
I remember feeling a lot of emotions of fear since I was really young. And I don't know, I think maybe it's carried on to me with my adult life.
Denise tells me school life was also really lonely. Thousands of miles away in France, Isabelle Thuy Pilo felt the same way. Growing up, her Asian features made her an outcast among her peers and even her extended family.
My mother She was not accepted by my father's family in France, and we were always treated, her and I, as total, not only stranger, also, but very foreign, and like we came from another planet.
Today, Isabel teaches at SF State University. She's beautiful, confident, a poet and an artist. Identities she wouldn't have even dreamed about as a child.
For example, I remember when people will talk about me when I was present and they will use a word like she, I was really happy because it reminded me that I was a human being and not a it.
Like Denise, she remembers violent fights between her parents. Both women struggled through middle school and then high school. And at age 19, both came to the same tipping point.
This is a journal that I've kept since I was 19 and just captured, I think, a few months of my life.
Denise flips through a thick, black, leather-bound journal. She reaches one particular entry, dated December 2nd, 2002. Denise was still living at home in Ontario at the time.
One of the last sentences, it says, I can hear my mom and grandmother talking. I think they want to call poison control or something.
When Denise reads the entry, it sounds like she's reading someone else's words. But when she describes the day's events, she shifts in her seat and explains. That night, she was in the family bathroom, and she reached for a bottle of pills.
So I just was at the sink, just, I think I poured a lot in my mouth and just got the sink water and just started drinking, just took that whole bottle. Yeah.
Denise's memories after that are a little fuzzy. She remembers her sister finding her throwing up on the bathroom floor, her mother and grandmother panicking and yelling at each other, the 911 phone call, and waking up in the hospital.
And I think I was just upset. I was angry. I wish I didn't wake up.
At the same age, Isabel was in France. She was suffering so much from her isolation that she even had trouble speaking.
And when you cannot speak, you can internalize it and it can be self-destructive.
So much so that at the age of 19, Isabel also tried to commit suicide. She wouldn't describe what happened that day to push her over the edge, but she did admit this.
I made a few attempts. I never told anyone. And even in the U.S., actually, I think I had that happened again a few years later. I had nobody to talk to.
There's a cultural practice of dealing with your distress and your feelings, your negative feelings, difficult feelings, on your own before burdening others with them.
That's Joyce Chu, a clinical psychologist in Palo Alto. Now, there's no single indicator that says one person's more likely to attempt suicide than another. There's still very little known about why it happens at all, much less in Asian American women. But Chu says that experts do know that professional help for young women like Denise and Isabel doesn't come early enough, if at all.
By the time they finally seek professional help, the severity of their mental health problems are much higher than compared to every other group.
Also, if you met someone who was suffering from depression or having suicidal thoughts, Chu says you might not know it.
The literature shows that the Asian Americans tend to express their distress more in their body rather than in emotion terms. So if you talk to an Asian American person who's depressed, they might not say, hey, I'm sad and I cry every day and I feel blue. The questions that we tend to ask to assess for depression, instead they might say, hey, I have a headache, I have a stomach ache.
And so it's not surprising that psychiatrists often miss these signals. That's assuming that the patient comes in to see a doctor at all. After their first suicide attempts, Isabel and Denise took divergent paths when it came to their mental illness. Denise sought therapy, even though she lacked support from her family.
As far as treatment goes, too, I've done both inpatient and outpatient treatment. And I did group therapy. I tried antidepressants.
But so far they haven't worked, Denise says. Her last suicide attempt was in 2010, when she was 26 years old.
I still feel the same way about life. I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't know if I could get better or not get better. Yeah, it's just really frustrating, I think, for me.
Denise says she's still depressed and not getting help. But at least now she's able to talk about it and is an open advocate for others to seek treatment early on. When Isabel was Denise's age, she still hadn't addressed her suicide attempts.
I have put a lot of energy and drive to move forward and forget the person I was, because I'm not very proud of it. I want to kill her. I want to like, you know, she never happened.
When Isabel moved to the U.S., she says her English wasn't good enough to get treatment. Besides, she didn't have money or insurance. It wasn't until her mid-40s that she was ready to accept her former self. And that's when she reached out to Asian American artist Cynthia Tom. Cynthia asked Isabel an important question that would change the course of her mental health.
If you had a place of your own, what would it be?
Cynthia created and directs an art project called A Place of Her Own with the Asian American Women Artists Association. When she first started the project, she didn't know just how therapeutic a place of her own would be for participants like Isabel.
And she created this wonderful kind of nest of beautiful cotton strings and yarns and bamboo slats. And
put a feather on top of it. And the feather is a symbol that reminded me of my last suicide attempt or thought of committing suicide when I was in my 20s. Because I had this little feather coming from the ceiling just when I was really in a bad space. And I just thought that maybe it was one of my ancestors being there for me, because I didn't think my parents were for me. I didn't have a community. I didn't have a people. But I had this feather. And when that feather came into my hand, that's one very day, I changed my life around.
In the fall of 2010, Isabel showed her work at the Driftwood Salon in San Francisco. She enjoyed A Place of Her Own so much that she participated again in 2011.
And the reason I liked the art, the project, is because I didn't have to speak. Because it has to be, I didn't have to explain.
Cynthia Tom says that is the key benefit of art therapy. The ability to acknowledge past trauma without having to articulate it first. Still, Cynthia says it's not a replacement for treatment. But Isabel agrees that her experience participating in the project has helped her heal from her past.
It's a slow process where I can start to speak a little bit more about this, or write about a little bit more about it, or make space for me to reflect on those times.
For both Isabel and Denise, healing from a suicide attempt isn't something that's going to happen overnight, or in 1 year, or through one art project. It's something they're going to carry with them for the rest of their lives. But both women are beginning to find the courage to release what for so long they thought they had to hold inside.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Today, we're dedicating an entire episode to explore a single topic, mental health in the Asian American communities. KALW's Erica Mu reported on this issue for 6 months, producing 3 stories that illustrate the complexity of such a sensitive subject. As you just heard, one major study found that Asian American teenage girls and seniors register higher rates of depression than those of other ethnic groups. But women are not the only Asian Americans challenged by depression. Recent immigrants, often refugees, register high rates as well. Stanford University psychiatrist Dr. Darren Richarder says there's one group in particular he's been working with.
Cambodian refugees having PTSD, it's so much higher than what you would see in any other population that it's remarkable.
Richarder says that figuring out how to treat the Cambodian refugee community has meant rethinking the way we understand psychiatry and healing. KALW's Erica Mu takes us to San Jose for this final story in the series.
To find the Unify Event Center in San Jose, you have to weave your way through a huge parking lot, swing around the Walmart, and follow the music into a large banquet hall.
Thank you. Today is Khmer or Cambodian New Year. There are about 100 people in the hall right now, sitting around large circular tables while the house band warms up for the evening's party. It's a small crowd, but this is a small community. There's an estimated 12,000 Cambodians in the Bay Area. Khmer New Year is a positive reminder of their roots and homeland, despite the fact that so many came here under such traumatic circumstances. In the early 1970s, Cambodia was in the middle of a brutal civil war. Eventually, the communist Khmer Rouge, led by Pol Pot, seized power, and its reign was characterized by horrifying sites of massacre, known today as the Killing Fields.
I don't have any sibling right now. I don't have any brother, sister. I don't have any nephew, any niece. No, nothing. They killed the whole family.
That's Sopani Bay. She lives in San Jose now, but in April 1975, she was living alone with her three small children in Phnom Penh. That's when Khmer soldiers entered the city. She remembers the morning when the evacuation began.
The April in Cambodia is so hot, very hot, you know. I took my children to stay under the mango tree. The way that we go, we don't know where we go, you know. They just go, 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 but we don't know. They use a gun. Go, 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 go. They use a gun like that.
Bay is describing soldiers forcing her and her family out of her home. Over the course of many grueling months, Bay would watch each of her children die of malnutrition and disease as she worked in the concentration camps. She thinks about them every day and dreams about the terror at night.
I never dream about my life in the United States. Always dream back to Pol Pot regime. So like people try to kill me, try to cut me or something like that. Bad dream. And the other people like me also, they have bad dream. They have nightmare.
Most of the clients that we see that have PTSD will have pretty severe sleep disorders, where they have a good deal of insomnia.
That's Dr. Darren Richarder from Stanford University. He works with victims of political violence. He's also a psychiatrist for the Cambodian program at Gardner Mental Health Clinic in San Jose. He's been at Gardner for about 8 years, but things were different when he began.
So the psychiatrist's major function in this clinic when I joined it was simply to write prescriptions for antidepressants and sometimes antipsychotics.
Nevertheless, at the time, the Cambodian program was groundbreaking. There were Cambodian case managers and clinicians who spoke Khmer and guided group therapy sessions. Sopani Bay is one of the counselors, and she says her background helps others open up.
I trust them. They trust me also. When they complain about nightmare, I believe, because I have nightmare also.
A lot of our clients don't speak the language, don't speak English.
Bhopal Pen is also a case manager at Gardner. He says that there are more difficulties than just the language barrier when dealing with the community.
They don't read, they don't write, so there's a lot of paperwork that you need to fill out before you can see a doctor.
Over 90% of Cambodian Americans speak a language other than English in the home. About half have less than a high school education. So it's no surprise that the median income for Cambodian families is among the lowest of the Asian subgroups, at just over $35,000 a year. It's for those reasons, Penn says, that his clients have had trouble paying for and learning American systems, from insurance to public transportation.
Most of them don't drive. Most of them need to be picked up and then drop off. And that's what we arrange, so that there's a taxi picking them up and then dropping them off when they need to be seen here.
Gardner Mental Health provides help navigating social security, insurance, and legal issues. Penn himself makes house calls along with Bay, but he says they're still dealing with a serious culture gap.
We don't have a whole lot of terminologies for mental health. It's a new field to us because of the war. During the killing field, all scientific research or information were destroyed. I mean, there was no such thing. Books were burned during the killing field, so nothing was left.
But as much as the Cambodian population in America has had trouble understanding psychiatry, Western psychiatry has had trouble understanding Cambodians. Again, Dr. Richarder.
When I started practicing here, probably 80 to 90% of the medication clients that were seen here were on antipsychotic medications, medications used to treat disorders like schizophrenia, when they did not have schizophrenia or anything like it.
Richarder says doctors were confused when Cambodian patients would come in and complain about a ghost sitting on their chests. It happened a lot. Sopani Bay describes the feeling.
When I take a nap, during daytime, sometimes, it seems like it's something on my chest, heavy, too heavy, I try to wake up, but I cannot. Too heavy, sit on my chest.
If you came into any psychiatrist's office with that complaint and you started with that, and the psychiatrist will say, well, what is this person talking about? Is this person psychotic? Or is this person having, serious nightmares at night wherein, that's the experience of the nightmare?
For Cambodian patients, a ghost sitting on your chest is the best way to describe what they're feeling. Richarder says the best translation is sleep paralysis with hypnagogic hallucination, fancy language for the motor system shutting down during dream sleep, leaving you temporarily paralyzed. But simply understanding this sleep phenomenon doesn't necessarily move the conversation forward.
If you explain that back to a Cambodian person, even our case managers, if you say, well, no, that you're not being visited by a ghost. What's really happening with you is this appreciated, understood Western phenomena that we call sleep paralysis. They don't accept that at all. They'll say, no, I'm being visited by a ghost at night. Almost like you're not listening to me. You're not hearing what I'm saying.
After many of these kinds of conversations, the clinic decided to bring in a different kind of expert. Again, Bhopal Pen.
We brought in a monk. The monk have established their role as a healer. We, a mental health counselor, have not established that role yet in our community.
Dr. Richarder got the idea when he was visiting Cambodia a few years ago, observing how mental health groups were caring for survivors there. He found that in Cambodia, providers addressed mental health needs in spiritual terms.
All of them were linked to the temples in one way or another. And oftentimes they were sort of working in concert with the temples or working with the monks.
So Gardner now invites a monk to lead a meditation session in the clinic with the help of one of the Cambodian counselors. The program helps bridge the gap between Western psychiatry and Eastern spirituality. On a recent morning, Dr. Richarder walks me down a narrow hall until we reach a closed wooden door.
So they're here, you can tell.
He's referring to the row of shoes that are lined up outside.
Let me just interrupt them, and I'll ask Sopani to come out. Oh, there she is.
Oh, yes. Hi.
Sopani Bay is leading the meditation this morning. She's filling in for the monk who usually leads the session. Inside the small room, there are about five or six people sitting on the floor. Bay is reviewing lessons from previous sessions. Don't steal, don't kill. And then the meditation session begins.
Okay, we start. Right now we start.
For the next half hour or so, everyone sits quietly in a circle. One person falls asleep. Bay says that's okay. The point is to get people out of their houses and better connected with mental health services, if they're open to it.
Life is a struggle. You have to struggle to live in the United States.
These sessions have been going on for about 3 years now, and when asked whether they've been effective, Dr. Richarder hesitates before he gives a firm answer.
Well, this is probably part you're going to want to edit out, but I'm not sure. I mean, honestly, we've tried to capture that to the extent to which we've had a measurable impact. And, much of the material that we've actually tried to record has demonstrated, this impact that's unrealistically good.
He says the likelihood of a complete turnaround for this community in just a couple years is low, really low. The surveys have improved, but Richarder and his colleagues are still figuring out the right questions to ask. Still, the Cambodian program looks to be going in a good direction.
We are serving over 90 clients. We're having about 5 Cambodian-speaking staff. We've grown so fast.
And Richarder says that's important for everyone in the Bay Area, not just Cambodians.
You know, the Cambodian population in San Jose is a very marginalized and very complicated population, and this is our American community.
Back at the Unify Event Center in San Jose, you can almost see two different experiences of the celebration. The younger generation was born here, far from what their parents suffered under the Pol Pot regime. They're here to dance and connect with neighborhood friends. But for their parents, this is an important day to remember where they came from. It's a part of their home that they're still happy to have with them. In San Jose, I'm Erica Mu for Cross Currents.
Erica Mu's series on Asian American mental health was part of the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowships. That's a program of the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. If you or a loved one need support, you can find a list of resources at our website. It's kalw.org. You've been listening to a special edition of Cross Currents. Our series editor was Martina Castro. Today's stories were engineered by Seth Samuel and Chris Hoff. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. For KALW News, I'm Holly Kernan.